Good morning. Welcome to our worship service here at Theodore Parker Church. My name is Julie McVeigh. I've been a member here with my husband, Stan Gross, since 1994. I've had a number of roles, but currently I'm on the 300th Anniversary Celebrations Committee. And this service is an outgrowth of that process. If you are visiting for the first time, we extend a special welcome to you. Our congregation gathers from a variety of backgrounds and perspectives. We come together to support each other on our life quests. We explore religious ideas and moral questions, and together experience our spiritual lives. We care for one another and the wider community and the world through works of service. Wherever you are on your religious journey, whatever your belief or doubt, your financial circumstances, sexual orientation, gender identity, culture, or color, we welcome you. And we're very glad you came today. You'll see in the pew rack in front of you a yellow welcome booklet, which we invite you to take. Also found there is a yellow card. If you'd like to know more about the Theodore Parker Church or to receive our weekly electronic bulletin, fill it out, place it in the offering plate as it comes past you, and we'll get back to you. Please join us for coffee hour after the service. Follow the crowd through the door to your right. Go straight along the breezeway up the steps and into the parish house. Newcomers, look for the welcome table to find out more about our church and to find a name tag so that we can get to know you better. And for those of you who have these nicely made name tags, wear them. Take a moment now to look at the announcements on the back of the leaflet. And we'll take brief announcements from the floor. Kathy? What was the name of that organization?
It's called HEARTS, HEARTS, Homes for Elders at Risk Through
Health.
Okay. Just a brief announcement. People have probably been wondering what I do just before the worship service. We've been recording worship services, the entire services, and extracting the sermons from them since the beginning of this worship year. And many of them have already been uploaded to the website as we have the time to upload all of them. And the members of the congregation will be also able to get access to the entire services if you have this one.
That's great. Thank you. Okay. And a final notice, or a final announcement. The Theodore Parker, or the 300th Anniversary Group, has made copies of a commemorative book that was published in 1900 when this building was celebrated. We've made copies available. They're in notebooks that look like this. They're available to borrow, and they're in the lobby. So if you would like to read that, which is very interesting, one of the histories that has been written about the church is printed in it. And it's just a sweet little thing to read about the community as well as about the church. So if you'd like to, please take it, read it, and bring it back. Thank you. The words to begin our day are by Rabindranath Tagore. The same stream of life that runs through my veins night and day runs through the world and dances in rhythmic measures. It is the same life that shoots in joy through the dust of the earth, in numberless blades of grass, and breaks into tumultuous waves of leaves and flowers. It is the same life that is rocked in the ocean cradle of birth and death, in ebb and in flow. I feel my limbs are made glorious by the touch of this world of life. And my pride is from the life throb of ages dancing in my blood at this moment. This morning, we are going to hear about our church's past from the people who made the history happen. Each of the readings this morning have been taken from either a first or a second-hand account. We've tried to translate archaic language to make it easier for our more modern ears to understand. All of the readings will be read by someone who's been involved in planning or implementing the 300th anniversary events. And now, to begin our travel through time, from the Puritan 1712 church to the present, our first hymn will be sung using the style of singing a Puritan church would have in 1712. They avoided the use of all musical instruments in church, and in their church, the only music was vocal music. In that tradition, we are singing our first hymn as Michael Johnson will be leading us in the paraphrase of Psalm 90. In the Puritan days, they had song leaders who would sing a line, and then the congregation would sing that line back to him. The songs were usually songs that people knew, and so I'm hoping you remember this hymn tune that we're using. But Michael is going to provide great support for that.
Please stand if you're able. So once again, I'll sing a line and then you sing it back to me. Oh God, our help in ages past. Oh God, our help in ages past. Our hope for years to come. Our hope for years to come. Our shelter from the stormy blast. Our shelter from the stormy blast. And our eternal home. And our eternal home.
in order stood, before the hills in order stood, or earth received its frame, or earth received its frame. From everlasting thou art God, from everlasting thou art God, to endless years the same, to endless years the same. A thousand ages in thy sight, a thousand ages in thy sight, are like an evening gone, are like an evening gone. Short as the watch that ends the night, short as the watch that ends the night, before the rising sun, before the rising sun.
Let me sit down.
Now we would like to light the chalice. Could you light? Yes, please. And would you stand as you are able and read the words that are printed in this leaflet? Nothing worth doing is completed in our lifetime. Therefore, we are saved by hope. Nothing true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we are saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we are saved by love. Not the virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as from our own. Therefore, we are saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness. Thank you. You may be seated.
In 1706, Joseph Weld and 44 other people living in the west end of what was then part of Roxbury, commonly called Jamaica End or Spring Street, petitioned the General Court for permission to form a separate parish. They asked to be freed from the obligation of paying taxes to the old parish and also sought financial help for building a new meeting house. They did this, according to an account published in 1878, because their great distance from the first parish of Roxbury Meeting House resulted in great travail in going and returning, especially in winter and in bad weather. Church attendance was compulsory in those days, and making the round trip from the environs of West Roxbury to the first parish meeting house in Elliott Square could consume much of the day. The General Court took no action on this petition for reasons that are lost to history. But without waiting for the court's permission or financial aid, the 45 petitioners went ahead anyway and built a church on Walter Street in what is now the Arnold Arboretum and formed themselves into a congregation. In April of 1711, they sent a humble address to their fathers and elder brothers in town meeting assembled. In that document, they prayed for pardon, with a sincere desire to give Christian satisfaction for any wrong, disorderly steps in their late proceedings. They humbly acknowledge their offense in presuming so precipitately and rashly to prosecute such an important affair without the consent of the general court, the approval of their reverend and dear pastor, and the agreement of their ancient and honorable mother, the church, and the town assembly. They again humbly requested permission to be a distinct precinct, which would include all of their Christian neighbors who dwelt among them and who desired to join them. Among the several reasons put forward in support of this request was the following one, which gives some insight into the theological views of that era. As for the season and opportunity we took for our above mismanaged enterprise, that is, building the church without approval, whether this was the time agreeable to the approving will of God, we dare not assert, but the event proves it to be his permissive and determinate will, or else it would not have been accomplished. And blessed be of God in Christ, although we have morally erred because of our hasty time and manner thereof, yet, having obtained God's help, notwithstanding our unworthiness, we have been carried through and continue to this day. A rough translation into the current vernacular might go something like this. If God hadn't wanted us to build a new church, he would have prevented us from doing so. Since he did not, it's clear that we have his blessing, so how can you deny us yours? Thirty-two men signed the petition, including members of the Beacon, Bowen, Curtis, Davis, Fuller, Griggs, Lyons, Perry, Weld, and Whitney families. The congregation of the First Parish of Roxbury responded to the petition by voting to allow the new church to stand and to establish the new boundary of what would become the Second Parish of Roxbury. Their vote provided that the petitioners, together with all such as dwell on the south side of the aforesaid line who are willing to join with them, and do embody so as to maintain an able, learned, orthodox minister amongst them, shall be freed from any charge to the minister of the east end of the town, and also from charge to the repairing and sweeping of the meeting house, so long as they do maintain a minister among them, as aforesaid, and no longer. So, again providing a modern translation, you can have your own church on the other side of town and won't have to pay tax for maintaining this church so long as you employ a minister with appropriate credentials. Having received the blessing of the Mother Church, the Second Church of Roxbury, consisting of 18 members formerly belonging to the First, was gathered on November 2nd, 1712. On the 26th of that month, the Reverend Ebenezer Thayer of Boston was settled over them as their first minister.
I'm going to describe the period from 1773 to 1776. Between 1706 and 1711, as we've heard just now, the farmers in this area had built a meeting house to save themselves from the arduous trip from the westerly end of Roxbury to the First Parish of Roxbury Church, a distance of more than 6 miles along very poor roads and paths. This structure, the Second Church of Roxbury, was described as a crude building, likely with a thatched roof. Soon after, the town of Roxbury established the upper cemetery just to the north of the building. The parsonage was built south of the church at Cookson's Corner, at the junction of what is now known as Walter and South Streets. In 1733, 21 years later, the Massachusetts General Court legally formed the Second Parish of Roxbury, which included present-day Roslindale and Jamaica Plain, as well as West Roxbury. This act incorporated the Second Parish in Roxbury, quote, for the maintenance of public worship and a church ministry, close quote. All the occupants of this newly formed parish were to pay their taxes to the Second Parish of Roxbury. That same year, the mother parish refused to give assistance to maintain a minister or to repair the meeting house, indicating that the mother parish had been providing assistance for some time. Recently, we've discovered a map that General George Washington used during the Siege of Boston. One of the landmarks noted on the map was a church identified as Walter's Meeting House. This likely refers to the second minister of the church, Reverend Nathaniel Walter. This map, made by French mapmakers, was printed in 1775. The location of the meeting house is shown as being located on the Dedham Road, the old name for Walter Street. The location of the church was thus noted, likely because the gathering of the information predated the publication of the map. By this time, the church had been relocated to the Church Street location. However, the location of the cemetery had not changed. In 1903, when Walter Street was widened, remains were found which were said to have been soldiers killed in the Revolution. Those remains were reinterred in the cemetery. The assumption then was that the Continental Army had utilized the convenient consecrated ground for their war dead. Since the Dedham Road, the lifeline of the Army, connected them with their supplies in Dedham. Another possible explanation is that the remains came from the hospital in the Loring Greenhouse in Jamaica Plain, which also used the old cemetery to bury their dead. But back to our meeting house story. In 1766, the congregation recognized that after 60 years of being upgraded, patched, and mended, it had become clear that the Second Parish's building needed to be replaced. They voted then to construct a new building, but took no action at the time. 3 years later, in 1769, members of the Second Church living in the neighborhood of Jamaica Pond established their own local church, the Third Church of Roxbury. This church is known today as the First Congregational Society of Jamaica Plain. Reverend Bob Haney, our former minister and historian, recounted the following. It seemed proper for the Third Church of Roxbury to take some of the colonial silver, which had been donated to the Second Parish over the years. The request, however, was denied. In lieu of silver, the Second Parish agreed to pay the Third Church £15.06, or about $600. According to Samuel Draper's recollections, the Third Church paid the Second a £666.08 to help build the meeting house in the new location a mile further down from the plain. And in 1773, the old meeting house was torn down. Much of its lumber was used in constructing the new meeting house, including the sounding board behind the pulpit. A square and unadorned building, it was built at Cass's Corner, where Center, South, and Church Streets intersect. By 1821, after many upgrades and redesigns in the appearance of the church, a steeple was added. The plain meeting house's appearance became that of a quintessential New England church. It was from this venerable platform that in 1776, the Declaration of Independence was read to the populace by their minister, the aged and well-loved Reverend Nathaniel Walter.
Let us enter into a spirit of reflection and meditation on the following reading, taken from the teachings of Mohandas Gandhi. if someone with courage and vision can rise to lead in nonviolent action, the winter of despair can, in the twinkling of an eye, be turned into the summer of hope. It is possible to live in peace. Nonviolence is not a garment to put on and off at will. Its seat is in the heart and must be it must be an inseparable part of our being. It is possible to live in peace. Nonviolence, which is a quality of the heart, cannot come by an appeal to the brain. It is a plan of slow growth, growing imperceptibly but surely. It is possible to live in peace. If a single person achieves the highest kind of love, it will be sufficient to neutralize the hate of millions. It is possible to live in peace. The future depends on what we do in the present. It is possible to live in peace. We shall have a moment for silent reflection, meditation, and prayer.
This reading covers the period of 1832 to 1846. Theologically, the earliest members of the Second Church of Roxbury were Puritans and Calvinists. However, during the long ministry of John Bradford from 1780 to 1825, the congregation shifted to Unitarian beliefs with little or no controversy. The congregation adopted a more optimistic view of the nature and destiny of humankind, and in 1832, a new and simpler covenant was created. However, they did not formally adopt the Unitarian name. The parishioners of the Second Church in Roxbury were eager to entertain new interpretations and ideas. They found a kindred spirit when Theodore Parker was ordained as their new minister on June 21, 1837. Newly graduated from Harvard Divinity School and newly wed to Lydia Cabot, Theodore accepted the call of the West Roxbury Parish. Lydia's wealthy invalid aunt, Lucy Cabot, bought a house located at Center and Cottage Street, which is now St. Teresa Avenue. Theodore and Lydia lived with Lucy until her death. In his biography, Parker writes, I guess that must be the autobiography, right? About his West Roxbury days. Quote, "I soon became well acquainted with all in the little parish, where I found some men of rare enlightenment, some truly generous and noble souls. The simple life of farmers, mechanics, and milkmen about me, of its own accord, turned into a sort of poetry and reappeared in my sermons. As the green woods not far off looked in at the windows of the meeting house," close quote. The parish was small, 50 to 70 members, and not wealthy. They paid Parker only $500, $600 a year. But for him, its location near Boston and Cambridge allowed him good access to Harvard friends and colleagues, lectures, and libraries. As an accomplished scholar, these considerations were essential for him. His scholarly work at Harvard led most people to expect that he would spend the quiet life of a scholar. But that was not to be, although Theodore read voraciously and wrote thousands of pages of books, sermons, tracts, and letters in his life. His theology led him out of the study and into social change. For many, the high point of the life of this church was Theodore Parker's ministry. The church became known in his day and throughout the 20th century as Theodore Parker's church. His earnest goodness and belief in the responsibility of Christians for betterment of the world earned him a warm place in the hearts of his West Roxbury parishioners. His good friends, George and Sophia Ripley, who had founded Brook Farm, and other Brook Farmers frequently attended Parker's church. Reverend Bob Haney, former minister here, said, and I quote, "In preparing his sermons, Parker determined to preach nothing as religion that I have not experienced inwardly and made my own." Only a handful of his sermons have been printed. They are notable for their honesty and simplicity. Parker's mind ranged far. His studies introduced him to the major scholarly and social issues of his time. Hesitantly, he began to explore them with his congregation. They responded appreciatively, and some of them were fired by his inspiration. Close quote. Theodore was not prepared for the public uproar that his sermon, quote, "A Discourse on the Transient and Permanent in Christianity," close quote, caused. His own congregation had heard this sermon and had been unperturbed by it. Also, Unitarian listeners at the ordination were not initially offended, but it shocked some of the representatives of other Protestant churches to hear a Christian minister publicly say that believing in miracles was unnecessary to declare oneself a Christian. A public controversy was carried out in the Boston newspapers, calling Parker a heathen and worse. Parker's Unitarian colleagues largely abandoned and shunned him, fearing they would be labeled heretics as Theodore was. Parker found himself exiled to West Roxbury. The loss of his former Christian brothers was devastating to him. A group of influential men, calling themselves Friends of Parker, approached him in 1845. They had formed themselves into a congregation called the 28th Congregational Society, so that the people of Boston could hear Parker speak. They met in hired halls, not churches or sanctuaries, and thousands came to hear him. For a year, Parker preached mornings in Boston and in West Roxbury in the afternoons. After a year, it became impossible for him to continue dealing with the demands of the two congregations. He resigned from the First Church West Roxbury in February 1846. It was with sadness but earnest good wishes that they said goodbye to him. Parker also began lecturing on the Lyceum Circuit. The Lyceum movement in the mid-19th century contributed significantly to the education of adults in America. It provided for the dissemination of many important ideas in the time before the Civil War. Parker's messages addressed from theological and political bases the abolition of slavery, the future of a democracy, need for public education, economic injustice, and the rights of women. These lectures were heard by thousands of people from New England to the Midwest. Many became Parkerites. Abraham Lincoln's law partner, William Herndon, was one. He passed copies of Parker's sermons and lectures to Lincoln. Theodore Parker first said publicly, quote, "A democracy is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people," close quote. He also said that the, quote, "the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice," close quote. Both of these quotes were immortalized on the carpet President Barack Obama had created for the Oval Office. However, neither quote was attributed to Theodore Parker, but to Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King, both of whom were influenced by him. End of the reading.
Thank you. This reading is about the church from the years 1870 to 1890. By the late 1800s, the number of people attending and supporting the church dwindled. Half the financial support of the church came from people who had left the area but had, quote, retained enough interest to pay their pew rent, unquote. However, discontent had grown within the congregation. A contingent of members felt the decrease in membership was due to the church's location in the farmland between the growing suburbs of Roslindale and West Roxbury. They wanted to move closer to the busy center of West Roxbury, citing the decline in members and claiming that it made sense to move. A second group of members and the minister were opposed to leaving the meeting house because of the peaceful rural surroundings and its connection to Theodore Parker and his ministry here. Yet another group was dissatisfied with the minister of 20 years, Reverend Augustus Haskell. Now, fires had already played a role in the history of the church. In 1882, a fire at a member's home destroyed most of the records from the early years of the church. Then, on January 22, 1890, at 2:30 a.m., a fire badly damaged the meeting house of the First Parish of West Roxbury. On the next day, the Boston Herald reported that the fire had been, quote, confined to the front portion of the edifice, end quote. The chancel and pulpit were unaffected, but all the new cushions, carpets, books, etc., were ruined by water. The fire did not touch the organ in the gallery, but it was nevertheless ruined by water used to extinguish the flames. The Boston Herald story goes on to say, quote, when the firemen entered the cellar, they found a huge wood pile in flames, and it is now thought that the fire was of incendiary origin, end quote. Indeed, the listing in the Boston Fire Marshal record states that January 22, 1890, 2:30 a.m., Center Street, corner of South Street, two-story wood owned by First Congregational Society, occupied by the same, used for church, loss on the building, $2,605, insurance, $4,500, loss on contents, $375, insurance, $400, under investigation. In the fire department logs, the cause of the fire is listed as incendiary. At this time of unrest in the congregation, the fire was a crushing blow. There was controversy as to whether the old church could be repaired with the $2,605 that the insurance companies allowed or whether it should be moved to a new site in the middle of town. Those who wanted to move the church instead of building had it evaluated for repair. A builder's assessment of its condition stated that it was not possible to safely move it. During this time, it was discovered that the church did not actually own the building. There was no clear title to enable the church to sell the land. Therefore, sadly, the old church stood abandoned and empty until 1914, when it was finally razed and the property sold. Reverend Haskell, who had resigned in 1889 due to ill health, with others who wished to gather together the liberal element, formed the Unitarian Society in Roslindale. They met in public halls for 2 years until in 1892 the decision was made to build. Their meeting house was located on South Street between Walter Street and the railroad station. The Roslindale Church buildings still stand and currently house St. Mark's and St. Anna's Orthodox Christian congregation. The West Roxbury contingent also met for some time in the Highland Club, a large community social club. They raised the funds necessary to build the small Dedham stone building on Quarry Street, even before they were able to resolve the legal and financial issues around the former First Parish Church.
And I have more from the period from 1890 to 1914. A further bit of information about the buildings was given by the chairman of the 1892 Building Committee, Henry Manley, who was, quote, kind enough to talk with me concerning the time of changing from the old church building to the new, end of quote. Who me was is not revealed in the handwritten notes. The following paraphrased conversation took place sometime after 1914 when the damaged meeting house was torn down. In 1890, finally, it was decided that the change in location must be made. And some showed their loyalty to the old church building by trying to have it moved to a more central location. A builder came out to estimate on the work of moving the building, but pronounced it impracticable. Mr. Manley then explained to me that the church was originally organized as a territorial parish. The whole state was divided into similar territorial parishes. Under the law, as it stood in those days, the parish could tax anyone living within those territorial limits. Portions of those laws applied down to the time of moving. From the earlier time till 1921 in this church, it was supported by the sale and rental of church pews. People bought pews as they bought real estate. Thus, it was revealed in 1890 that the church property was not owned by the church itself, but was directly owned by the pew owners. The method to obtain title to the church property, following the advice of council, was to levy a tax on all the pews, which could still legally be done. If the tax levied was not paid by a certain time, the pew could be sold at auction. The people agreed not to pay the taxes, and the pews were bid at auction for the benefit of the church, thus securing the title beyond dispute, before they attempted to build a new church. The money received from the fire insurance was about $2,500, which was of substantial help. The church's sanctuary building was not erected then, but the parish house was our cozy church home for almost 10 years. Mr. Frank Alden planned the parish house, and knowing that he was with the architectural firm of Longfellow, Howe, and Alden makes us better appreciate his high architectural standing, and especially his kindness in giving his valuable services. For the plans of the parish house were given were Mr. Alden's gift to the church. Henry Seaver, architect of the sanctuary building, dictated a note about the building of the 1892 and 1900 buildings at Center and Corey Streets. The fire of 1890 damaged badly, but did not destroy any of the architectural features, and at that time were made measured drawings of the entire church and the pulpit, which are now on file with the Society of the Preservation of New England Antiquities, Boston, together with photographs of the exterior and interior. This is a quote, by the way. The pulpit, clock, and bell were saved and are in use at the new church. The rest of this is going to be a quote, part of the same quote from Henry Seaver. The stone building now used as a parish house on the corner of Center Street and Corey Street, built in 1890-91, was planned by Longfellow, Alden, and Harlow, architects of Boston. Mr. Alden was of West Roxbury and of a very old family. He and Mr. Longfellow had worked with H.H. Richardson in his Romanesque work, and this small parish shows a little of that style in the round arches and roof trusses. The Dedham granite that was used was not uncommon in those days in railroad stations and other buildings. This building was used as the church till 1899, when the present church was built. The architect of this building and the stone connecting passage to the old parish house was Henry M. Seaver, a parishioner who had been a draftsman in the office of Longfellow, Alden, and Harlow, and who was a student at MIT when he planned this work. The style of the first smaller building was followed. The Theodore Parker window that had been in the parish house was moved into the new place over the pulpit. This window was designed by Tiffany & Company, New York. The east circular window was a gift of Valentine Bartsch, a parishioner, and designed by him and made by him. Dedham granite was no longer being commercially quarried, but an old, overgrown, disused quarry east of the road between Dedham and Westwood was opened, and enough stone was gotten out for the building. It was thought that the long vestibule under the gallery would be needed for added seats in the church, and the partition was made so that it could be removed. The original plans of the church are in the files of Harding and Siever, Pittsfield, Massachusetts. End of quote.
That reading was by Cindy Bergeron, whose name was omitted from the leaflet. I wanted you to know her. Please stand as you are able, and let's sing together the hymn number 296 in the gray hymnal. May be seated. Gretchen.
We pick up the story now from about the 1890s up until the merger in 1962 with the Roslindale Church. Until the 1950s, both the West Roxbury and Roslindale Unitarian congregations flourished, and relations between the two groups were neither unfriendly nor close. Village life revolved around the churches and the various organizations which grew out of them, such as the West Roxbury Unitarian Club. This group of men explored many religious and social issues of the day, meeting at the Highland Club across Center Street on the Corey Street corner. You can get a facial there at Elizabeth Grady today. Although both churches had women's auxiliary organizations, which undertook various projects, both for the church and the wider community, such as knitting items for soldiers during the wars. The West Roxbury Players put on plays in the parish house, which on one occasion, at least, had newspaper coverage complete with a wonderful old picture of the players in the Peabody pew, based on a commonly read book published in 1907. However, with outward migration from the city to the suburbs that both communities experienced, each congregation dwindled and aged. The buildings suffered from neglect, and they struggled to survive. Former minister Ken McLean wrote a narrative that describes how Roslindale and West Roxbury came together in 1962 to form the Theodore Parker Church. And this is a long quote by Reverend McLean. In the summer of 1960, McLean, the student minister of the Roslindale Church, had resigned on his graduation from Divinity School, and the minister of the West Roxbury Church resigned to take another church. representatives of the two churches met together to consider the possibility of sharing the services of a minister, and Ken was called officially by the two churches in November. For 2 years, services were conducted at 9:45 a.m. in Roslindale and 11:15 in West Roxbury. From the beginning of the joint ministry, the two churches combined their church schools and shared the expense of the office and a student assistant minister. At the beginning of the second year, the newsletters of the two groups were combined. Probably the most significant step toward unity taken during the first year was the decision to have joint services at Christmas and Easter. Christmas fell on a Sunday in 1960, and on that Christmas morning, members of both churches gathered for worship in the West Roxbury building. There were 100 in attendance, and there was a choir made up of members of both churches. On Easter Sunday, 1961, the joint morning service was conducted at the Roslindale Church. Again, there was a joint choir and a large attendance from both churches. These two services had no official significance at the time, but they were important symbolic steps toward a closer unity. In the spring of 1961, a motion was passed at the annual meeting of the Unitarian Church in Roslindale that further exploration be conducted with the First Parish, West Roxbury, toward a merger. The incident which precipitated this discussion was the revelation that the heating system in the Roslindale Church would soon require major repairs. Sounds familiar. The feeling developed among some of the leaders present that night that it did not make sense to put that money into the Roslindale plant if the two groups together could join their resources and membership in one plant. Although no official decisions were made that night, still the general shape of the discussion was formed. It was assumed from that time that if the merger took place, the Roslindale building would be sold, and the merged church would keep the West Roxbury buildings. This decision was not forced by the West Roxbury people, although they were pleased by it, but it seemed the most reasonable to the Roslindale people, even though they found it difficult to make the break from their own warm and hospitable little church. The major factors in this decision were the superior location of the West Roxbury Church on a main intersection and the better condition of the West Roxbury buildings, especially the parish house. A joint merger committee should be formed with five representatives from each church, plus legal counsel and the minister to draft a plan for a merger to be submitted to the membership of both churches. And that's the end of the quote. The two congregations approved the merger unanimously and joined the churches together at a meeting of the new church on June 12, 1962. The Theodore Parker Unitarian Church, named for its most famous and still warmly regarded minister, was formed in time to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the original church, Ye Second Church of Christ in Roxbury, which had been divided for 70 years and was now reunited.
This is the ongoing history after the merger of the church. Even after the merger, the Theodore Parker Church continued to struggle through the 1970s. At a meeting of the church members on June 9, 1976, their plight was made clear. The membership had to vote on whether to sell the church buildings to any of three prospects. Two of the churches wanted to buy the building. Meadville Lombard Theological School wanted the statue. The latter's offer was to look after the buildings and the congregation until the numbers dwindled to six. At that point, they would sell the buildings and take the statue of Theodore Parker to their campus in Chicago. Meadville Lombard's interest in the Theodore Parker Church stemmed from their commitment to liberal religious education and their esteem for Theodore Parker and his contributions to liberal religious theology. The congregation courageously voted to refuse all of the offers by a vote of 18-6. With the sale of the parsonage on Emmonsdale Road, they determined that there was enough money to keep going for about a year and a half, A standing committee was then to review the status of the church every 6 months thereafter. They struggled on, just barely surviving. In the 1980s, Reverend Kimball, then Reverend Robert Haney, agreed to provide Sunday services to the tiny congregation. Fewer than 20 congregants. An energized cadre of young adults fueled a slow increase in the number of people attending and joining the church. In 1987, at the request of the Mass Bay District of the Unitarian Universalist Church, or Association, excuse me, the Western Unitarian Universalist Church partnered with the Theodore Parker Church. They offered financial support and the labor of members who rolled up their sleeves and pitched in to paint, plant, and fix up the buildings and grounds. The Western Church also shared its ministerial interns with the church during these critical years of growth. One of those interns, Mary Ann Powers, in 1991 wrote, "Theodore Parker Church has survived and grown due to the persistence, love, and support of the parishioners in West Roxbury and Weston who have shared a vision of liberal religious community and who have been willing to put up their minds, their backs, along with their hearts and souls into it." In 1990, the Mass Bay District presented the Theodore Parker Church with their Church of the Year Award. As part of a packet that we assembled to present to ministers that we were interested in calling for a permanent position, members were asked to present personal histories of their experience with the church. As part of today's service, I was asked to provide some excerpts of the one that I had presented to that package. In 1983, I was brought to this church by a sign. Though it was a small green and white sign with an arrow on the VFW Parkway that said Unitarian Church, it was a sign all the same. The first time I attended Theodore Parker was last service in June prior to the summer break. When the minister, Dick Kimball, found I was from the area and Unitarian, I was offered immediate membership into the church, as well as an immediate job of transporting most of the congregation, who was too old to drive, back and forth to the church in the fall when we resumed. He remarked that if I didn't drive them, we wouldn't have anyone in the pews for Sunday. Of the 20 people I met that day, only two remain with the church, John Lambert and Gretchen O'Neill. I was also asked what committees I would like to be. Not to be on, but to be. The membership was so low, the standing committee acted as general committee for all business. I returned to the church that day to help Dick plant a memorial shrub outside the parish hall. As there were no shovels, we made do with a large knife from the kitchen. There was a lot of making do. In the next year, the neighborhood demographics and the 75-year-old median age of our congregation combined to continue the low, slow, steady decline in membership. Reverend Kimball, exhausted from 90-hour work weeks, attempting to keep the church going, experienced several family emergencies and was unable to continue as our regular minister. We were profoundly lucky that our guest minister, Bob Haney, who was preaching once a month, agreed to fill in and agreed to take on the church's clerical duties for a pittance. By then, a pittance was all the church could afford, its active membership having shrunk to a handful of folk, mostly elderly. The church had virtually no money and a building that exemplified the phrase deferred maintenance. It had no committees save a standing committee that spent hours discussing How many rolls of paper towels per week did the Irish dancers really need to use? We struggled to find anyone we could add to our membership. Many potential members were horrified to find out we were a church more dysfunctional and needy than they were. In 1991, my first meeting as standing committee chair saw half the committee members resigning due to disagreements between historically disgruntled old members and several new members of the church who had been shoehorned into the congregation. With the departure of the disenfranchised, we all had to assume additional jobs just as we had believed things had started to improve. By the spring, everyone was burned out to the point of quitting themselves. Our immediate future looked so bleak, I considered whether I should propose dissolving the church at our next standing committee. I knew the answer was no when I found out the next day that John Lambert had spent the entire night in the basement of the parish hall keeping a sump pump running to prevent it from being flooded. We hung on for that year and a bit more until the people you see in the congregation now arrived to lend a hand to make us the open-minded, diverse community we are today. And symbolically, the shrub planted with Reverend Kimball many years past is still there, along with all the other trees that have joined it at the side of the parish hall.
Thank you, Doug. The offering will now be taken. All freely given gifts will be accepted with gratitude. Thank you.
which have made us who we are.
That's okay. Our closing words. Our church through the years have received the themes of self-reliance, action, and renewal, growing from our origins on Walter Street through the 1890s, rebuilding the church from the ashes, our reunion in 1962, and to the resurgence beginning in 1980. These themes have recurred. In 1891, only 1 year after the church fire, Mrs. B.M. Sparhawk's annual report ends with the courageous statement, which in 1926, Catherine Andrews echoed. We, current members of the Theodore Parker Church community, can say with them these words. We have worked long and hard and can but feel gratified with the result, but let us not think that the work is finished. It has in reality just begun. During the years to come, let each and all of us join in forwarding that true social spirit, which is the essence of all church life, and make these rooms, which are entrusted to us, truly a church home. Thank you.
Dad. It's really beautiful.
Dad,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
How you doing?
Yeah, I think it could have been.